Hi, welcome to UX Design and Education for Effective Monitoring Tools. As Connie Wynn just said, I'm Amy. I'm an observability engineer. I've been doing this for a few years at a couple of different companies. This seems really presumptuous of me to say right at the beginning, but if you like this talk, maybe you want to hear me talk about other things I really care about tomorrow at the plenary panel. It's at 4 o'clock, and you can find it on the you can find it on the conference program. There's my homepage and my Twitter handle, and I hate every picture of myself in existence, so that's a drawing of me. And let's get into it. If you wanted to follow along on your laptop, you can go there, and it's already on speaker deck. I know sometimes people just want to look at their own screens. So that's the link. I'll leave it for a few seconds in case anyone wants to write it down. It's also on my Twitter, so you know you can find everything. You don't have to write anything down. All right, I'm going to keep moving. So today we're going to talk about why you should care about user experience, and then we're going to jump right into the lessons. We're going to divide up what we want to talk about into two really broad categories of sharing what you know with your users and then designing what they want. And of course, it's a talk, you have to recap, so there's the agenda. So let's get into motivation. First of all, I want to recognize that not everyone here is working in observability or monitoring or even SRE. A lot of you might be in a totally different field. But I want to say that probably whatever team you're on, you're building tools for other engineers to use, or even if they're your own teammates. And so I think there is something to be taken away from this talk, even if you're not directly building tools yourself in-house. And I want to, the way I like to think about it is something kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where the bottommost tier would be your team culture. Your team culture is totally a part of the user experience of working with your team. The way you interact with other engineers is very important. If you're not welcoming, if you're not educating people, or if you're not letting people ask questions and answering them in a timely and understandable manner, that's a part of your user experience, and I'd say the most fundamental part of your team is your team. So after that, there's your documentation. If it's not easy to find, easy to understand, and updated, that reflects poorly on your team as well. So I realize that I am going to be talking about tools, but the tools do come after you've already settled out everything with your team and your documentation. I had this fourth part of the pyramid, and I kind of thought I have nothing to say about the fourth part. There's only really three pieces here. So, you know, maybe if you're thinking about user experience and you're real serious and you have a lot of money, you should pay for vendors. But if you don't have that kind of money, you're in the right place. So yes, this talk will be talking about tools, but we can all control the team and documentation. So even if you're not directly like writing out gigantic web applications, the lessons I hope are general enough. So let's move on. Why should we care about user experience? I think this is a really, you might think this is a really obvious question, but it's less obvious when you think about the fact that we're working in internal tools. When you're talking about a product that's facing like millions of users, of course the user experience matters. If the users don't like it, they'll go away to a competitor. And with internal tools, you have no competitors. If your tool is bad, people still have to use it. So you might be like, I have a captive audience. I don't have to make anything good. They have to use it no matter what. Doesn't matter. And I want to start by saying, first of all, how many of you have used Graphite? And how many of you have used OpenTSDB? These tools make me angry. and I want to say, like, I love Graphite and I love OpenTSDB. I feel like when I went from Graphite to OpenTSDB and I realized I could have tags, I was like, this is amazing. My data is so like segmented, and I was happy. But then I like started using this interface, and I was like, I don't know what all these buttons mean. I don't know what's going on here, but there's just so much information. So, you know, you can see that there's a divide between like the powerfulness of a tool and the user experience there. And so what I really want to say about this is that there's a whole market for building monitoring tools or just tools for engineers that have great user experiences. This is a screenshot from Monitorama 2017's sponsor page, and you can see like the top like three or four rows are all vendors who are selling you a tool that has a great user experience. I realize that sometimes they are trying to sell you on like scale and reliability, but a lot of it is also like, we're going to help you make something that's intuitive and easy to use for everyone at your company. And so there's clearly a demand for this if there are so many companies that are working on this problem. And so I realized like it's really fun to like bash on tools that are open sourced and not very well resourced, but that's not a really great argument that you can like bring back to your manager or you can bring back to your exec team and like get buy-in for. So I'm going to feed you some buzzwords that you can use to sell your exec team on why you should invest in this. First of all, you want to prevent misunderstandings. You know, you're at a company with like 10 people or 100 or 1,000 people, but unless you literally work at a monitoring company, not everyone at your company should know about how to use a monitoring and time series data. You might have hired some designers, you might have hired people who are really good at front-end development, you might have even hired people like, who are doing like growth and SEO, and all those people don't need to know about time series data to do their jobs, but it is an enhancement to their jobs. It's really easy to misinterpret this data because it's complicated. So you don't want people at your company to reach the wrong conclusions just because the tool made them confused. The next buzzword is developer velocity. You want people to reach conclusions faster. You know, you have that friend who's woken up at 2 a.m. because of an incident, and she just wants to go back to sleep. You want her to like reach the conclusion, like figure out the root cause of the incident, if there is a root cause, and go back to sleep. So hopefully, if your tools can help that person reach their conclusions fast enough, everybody wins. And then you want data democracy, which is like the greatest buzzword ever. You want people to reach conclusions independently. What I think is really great about time series data, it's not just about like reliability and like 4 nines or 5 nines or 10 nines. It's about like people using data and segmenting tags by like what device type or what country people are coming from or what browser people are using. And I have no idea what the significance of that data is, but maybe a product developer really wants to know, like, are people in Chile having internet connectivity problems? And that's a really good questions to ask. And those are questions that you, as a like observability engineer, might not even think to ask. So if you let people independently use your tools, your whole company is better for it. And so I want to say not everyone like remembers all these words. I feel bad that I put so many words on a slide. And so what I really want you to remember from in summary of this is that user experience helps people work correctly, quickly, and independently. And so now I want to talk about one of my favorite quotes about software engineering, which is, the fastest way to become a 10x engineer is to help 10 other engineers do their jobs better. I don't know who first said this. I think it's just one of those like isms that floats around the internet. But I think it's a really comforting thing for an infrastructure or system administrator to hear, because if you're a product engineer, it's really easy for you to say, like, I built this feature, I can measure the engagement, this many users came back to use my feature, I've created value for this company. And when you're on the infra side, you're kind of like, oh man, my work is like supporting this company, but it doesn't directly translate into like business value. And so whenever I feel that way, like, oh man, am I really bringing value to anybody? Like, am I doing something worthwhile? I just remember that like the more that I do something that makes other people's jobs easier, then the more I have actually helped my company and brought value by being kind of a multiplier. And so that's one of my favorite quotes about software engineering, and I hope a good motivation for why user experience matters. And now we can move into the good stuff. In terms of sharing what you know, one of the first things I would recommend is to think about when you're overloading people with too much information versus when you can kind of just let them feel it out and figure it out on their own. So here's an example of like an alert. I have a metric. I want to see when the errors are greater than 5. So you think like, oh, I guess that makes sense. But maybe if you've been looking at alerts for a long time, you might think, wait, what does that mean? Like, are you going to aggregate? Are you just checking when it passes number 5? What happens if I'm looking at a time series metric that's like really spiky, and sometimes it keeps passing and unpassing, going below 5. Do I want to alert every single time? Am I going to get an email? Those are big questions. And you know, if someone tells you, like, I want to make a metric and I want to know when I have more than 5 errors, you could start by saying and by like, asking them all those questions, or you can kind of assume based off of your own knowledge that they have a certain meaning, and you can help them build that tool or build that alert. So here's an example of a like alert previewer. You can see at the bottom it says aggregate series by average, which means it will look at the data over the past like 10 minutes, and then it will average it, and then it will check if that number is greater than 5. And so it kind of helps you smooth out those spikes if there are any. But that's really complicated, and that takes a while to wrap your head around unless you've been doing this for like more than a few hours. But what's really important is that there's this great previewer at the top where you can see that there's a difference between when you're notified and when you're when the alert is actually going off. And you know, every time your alert goes off, you don't necessarily want to get a page or an email. And so you can kind of see there's a difference there, and you, as a user, you can kind of just feel out like, hey, I can see in this line when I want to get emailed. Let me just keep tweaking this until those red rectangles look like what I want them to look like. And so people can kind of intuitively feel this out. And so that's one way you can like stop people from thinking too hard about the details when it's like when there's an information overload, and make it so that they can kind of just feel out what they should be doing instead. The next thing I want to talk about is best practices. I think on the previous couple of slides when I said averaging, probably someone in here would start cringing. They were like, no, you shouldn't use averages. Averages are bad forever. But the thing about all these rules, like don't use averages, is that it depends on the context. You are the person who was hired by your company to like understand your company's situation and to apply what you think are the best behaviors. And so if you're in your situation, you're like, averages are bad, don't do them, then don't include them in your tool. So you know what is the right thing to do probably for most of your engineers, and so you should direct people towards that. One example of this is this like Mad Libs thing from the previous couple of slides. We knew that most people in our case want to go back like 10 minutes, they want to average things in general, and they always want to check by 30 seconds. We knew that we have a cache, so we were like, okay, checking 30 seconds, it's fine, even if they're loading up 10 minutes of data, it's not a huge resource strain. But if you know that you can't check every 30 seconds, then you know you can tweak that. But what we did is we filled in all these with like the good default behaviors so that people would only have to look at this when here and write out what their metric is. And then they don't even have to think about the rest of it unless it becomes relevant. And so, you know, if you have a form and you want people to fill in every single blank, think about what people will generally fill out and then just fill it in. Then they will have to think about it until it becomes relevant. And the third thing, kind of the reverse of the second, is the pitfalls. You know what is not a great what's not a great behavior for your users, and so you can kind of just steer them away from that and make it more difficult to do that thing. In our case, with the same tool, we knew that our data would arrive within about 5 minutes, but it wasn't instantaneous because you're collecting data from like 1,000 hosts, you're going to aggregate it. It takes a while. And so whenever we heard someone say, I don't want to do the aggregating, I don't want to do the average, I just want to look at the last point in the line, we would say, oh no, you can't do that because that's usually going to be zero. So yes, final point is an option, but we hit it in the drop-down menu because no one clicks on drop-down menus. So I know it's sad. It feels bad because like a lot of this is like make things as easy as possible. But you know, people do, the more friction there is, the less people will do things. So we want people to do averages, we don't want to do final point, so we just hide the final point so that you have to actively choose to do it, and then you hopefully know what you're doing. And then, you know, you can think about like maybe adding some more like helpful advice. The jury's still out on this one. I feel like Microsoft kind of proved that it's not the greatest idea. But you know, you can think about like maybe if someone's gonna like click on final point, maybe you could add a little like, hey, maybe you shouldn't do that kind of message. I haven't tried it myself. I think it would end up pissing people off. So maybe that's not good advice. So that's sharing what you know. And next we're going to talk about designing what your users want. And I guess I think of this a lot as like thinking about what kinds of feelings people have when they're using your tool. And most of those feelings are pretty negative. People are usually angry, they're stressed out, they're frustrated, they're tired. And if you can mitigate those feelings as much as possible, then you're already creating something that's pretty delightful. So first of all, people want performance. I know it's not what you immediately think of when you think of user experience, but it's probably the most important thing for your tool. Like even if it's like the shiniest tool ever, it's like really easy to use. If it takes you like a minute to load up like an hour of data, everyone's gonna be angry using it and all that stuff doesn't matter. So performance is probably a understated and huge part of user experience. And so I want to talk about some cool things you could do in the field of monitoring. I think there's a lot of really great research like about how to store time series data. So on the back end, you know, you could roll data over long time ranges. If you have like a year of data, you don't necessarily need 10-second resolution for that whole year. You should think about rolling up your data so that, first of all, you're storing less and your costs are smaller, and second of all, the data returns more quickly. And then if you're Facebook, you can think about storing the latest data in like an in-memory time series database. I mostly included this just because I got excited because I found out a Beringue is like a type of gorilla, which is like really cute. The gorilla paper is like this really great research paper about how to store time series data in a very compact way. And the Beringue project is an open source time series database that you can play around with and see if it meets your needs. And so that's one way of serving data really quickly. And then you might think about like adding a cache. There's an open source project called Splicer that's built by Tern. And it does pretty much exactly what you think it does. And you know, these are some cool backend ideas, but they're gonna take like more than like a year to do. So nobody got time for that. Unless you're literally Facebook, who's doing this? But there's some really great things you can do that will actually help your performance that will take like maybe a week or so. And so there's so much low-hanging fruit. For example, let's say I have 1 week of data and I want to click back to get 2 weeks of data because I want more context. Even if it takes approximately about the same amount of time to load up 1 week versus 2 weeks of data, it doesn't matter to me as a user because I feel like it's inefficient because I'm like seeing that it's loading up that 1 week of data that was already on my screen. So the user just gets like frustrated. So if you just load up that 1 week of data that you don't have and then show it on the screen alongside the week of data that's already there, people are already happy, even if there's not a like legitimate performance improvement. It's about the perception. Another thing that I thought was really interesting for us was we would use OpenTSDB, and apparently there's some sort of thing where HBase will just stop responding to like any request if you send it too many requests, which I think is kind of how I respond to problems in my own life, so I understand. You know, you can prevent the user from requesting data over and over. If you can see them like hitting the refresh button over and over, don't send all those requests. You have the power to do that. You know that the data is going to be the same no matter how many times they do it. So, you know, let them maybe stop them from hitting it over and over again, and it will save your backend. And then in terms of like dashboards where you have maybe 12 or 50 graphs on a page, if you load them all up at once, then some of the graphs that are not even showing on the screen will start loading, and the ones that are actually on the screen will not load. So it seems like a really obvious thing, but load the graphs that are actually showing on the screen. Then you're saving a ton of time, and people are happy. And so you can see that these kinds of changes are, in terms of complexity, it's not too difficult to implement, but it ends up changing how your product feels, and it can actually help with the real performance of your system. So there are some low-hanging fruit for you. And second, I would say of all the things I'm going to talk about today, this is probably my favorite thing, the exploration. So you know, you can like start taking notes and stuff. But people are afraid and anxious when they use your tool because maybe it's their first time using a monitoring tool. Maybe they didn't use it at their old job. They don't know how your system works, so they're already confused. So you want to make it as easy as possible for them to try things out. And the first, most important thing that drives me like so crazy is this. Don't mess with this. Don't mess with any of this. And you're thinking, like, what about it? It's an address bar. Don't mess with that. Or that. Or that. Or fucking that. None of it. Don't touch it. It doesn't deserve to be touched. How many of you have used a tool where one of these things was broken? I'm kind of sad that it's like not all of you. Okay, the back button. If you're loading stuff up in Ajax and you show more data on the screen and I hit the back button and I end up on the home page or I even end up like on the new tab page and all my data is gone, I just get so upset because like I tried so hard. I worked to make that data and it's gone. And then I want to refresh it because I just want to know more about what's going on. I just want to see if there's any new data. And then my whole dashboard is gone. Or I like copy the URL and I want to like send it to my coworker so that they can see it and they're in another country. I want them to see the same things that I see, but you can see that URL, example.com, it's not RESTful, it's just the homepage. And then as for the new tabs, like let's say you're doing some like bullshit single page app thing and you stop using 8 like anchor A tags, then you can't open things in a new tab because you're doing this like on click stuff. Just stop it. Stop with the JavaScript. It doesn't need that. I've used so many vendor tools where one or more of these things was broken, and like the native browser features are things that, like the things that everyone uses are the things that you should expect to be able to use. So really, if you remember anything, you just remember like the address bar. Just look at it. Make sure all those buttons actually still work. And then I just want to jump into accessibility for a second. I realize this like is literally an entire field of study, and also probably the topic of another 45-minute talk. I'm just going to give you like a window into what I want to say about that. What I want to say is that accessibility, yes, it does help people with disabilities, but also when you think about the kinds of improvements you could make for the sake of accessibility, almost everybody wants those improvements as well. So I'll give some examples. I'll give the highlight reel of like things that I think are important about accessibility, but I really encourage you to like take a seminar about it, read up on it. It's a really cool topic. I learned a lot of things that I did not know. So first of all, color contrast. I, as a person who's generally like, I know I have glasses, but generally I don't have vision problems. I didn't think very much about this, and then I realized that like, maybe it's a little bit harder to see here, but like when I look at this on my screen, it's super easy to read. The five boxing wizards jump quickly. But you know, we're all people who look at computers all the time. We're all dealing with eye strain. Why make it harder for people to read things? If you think about the person who like maybe doesn't have the greatest vision, and you just make your text, your foreground, your background contrast more, that's helping everyone. And you know, if you're waking up in the middle of the night, you don't even want to like try to like, you're already squinting at your screen. Why make it harder? And then in the same vein, you know, you want customizable color schemes. I Googled this morning. It turns out that 8% of men have red-green color blindness, and like the number is like way smaller for women for chromosome reasons or something. But the point is that a lot of people suffer from red-green color blindness, but we as an industry have decided that red means bad and green means good, when they can look the same for so many of us. That's mind-blowing to me. So it's not like you have to stop using red and green, but you know, maybe you can use red and black. Or you can just let people choose what colors they want. What's really great about this is that, let's say you have like 10 time series lines on a graph, and all the colors end up the same because you like, let them choose random colors. That's super confusing. A lot of times, if you just let people have like the same four colors, then they'll cycle over again, then you won't be able to see anything. If you let people just choose the color scheme they want or customize the colors for each line, first of all, you're hitting a huge accessibility problem, but also everyone's happy. I kind of ranted about this already, but what I mean here is navigation bars that aren't controlled by JavaScript. If you have like some CSS thing where you're like hovering and then like suddenly like a new like hamburger menu comes out, that shit doesn't even work on mobile. First of all, like you can't hover on mobile. So like if someone left their laptop at home and they like have their phone, they're like trying to like figure out what's going on, they can't even use your thing. That's already a good enough reason to stop using the hover. But if you're doing a bunch of JavaScript stuff and you're not just making like a semantic HTML navigation bar, that's not even navigatable by anyone who's using like a keyboard navigator, like a screen reader, for example. So you want your things to be readable by screen readers because that will make it easier for everyone to use your tool. And then keyboard navigation. I got really excited because I can see that there's like some Vim stickers in the audience. How many of you use Vim? Nice. Vim's the greatest text editor. Don't fight me. Or do fight me? Is that the saying? Yes, fight me. Okay. But it turns out everyone loves keyboard navigation. Also, people with RSI and motor impairments love keyboard navigation. If you just make a HTML website that is like semantic, again, it's a big word, and like well ordered, then like usually a screen navigator can handle it. But if you break that by like putting divs everywhere, you're going to have a lot of problems for anyone who has RSI, for example. And then the last thing that I really want to call attention to is like, you need to make it really obvious what needs to be paid attention to for anyone with cognitive impairments. And I know like a lot of people are like, cognitive impairments, I don't know anyone who has those in tech, which is a fucked up thing to say or think. And it's a very narrow-minded view because you don't know what your coworkers are going through. But second of all, if you do this, then and you make it more clear what people need to do, everyone wins. That's the whole point of this talk. So, you know, make it really obvious, like kind of like call out what needs to be done, and don't just like throw everything on the screen where you don't even know what's going on. So that's the spiel about accessibility. I know I ignored a ton of topics, but you know, it's a really important thing. And even if you don't buy the argument that you should do it because it's the right thing to do for people with disabilities, you should remember that it's also the right thing to do because everyone would benefit from having these kinds of features. And then I'll keep this one short. I know that it's like less heavy than accessibility, but previews, the last thing about exploration. One thing I really like about one tool I really like that does previews well, in my opinion, is Terraform. You can write your code out, you can plan your infrastructure, and then when you're done, it'll give you a diff of what's gonna get deleted, what's gonna get added. I know the color coding isn't great, but in terms of accessibility, but you know, you can see what's changed. I think that's a really neat way of building a command line tool that lets people explore without being afraid. And then a more obvious example, of course, we just talked about alert previews. You want to try out your alert before you get paged like 10 times in a row. And here's a screenshot from Datadog. Also, I actually got these from Google Images. So I don't know if there's like sensitive data on here, but sorry, Chef. I was trying to be more general, like use more tools and stuff. So to recap, don't break the basic browser features. Think about accessibility, because accessibility really does help everyone at your company. And make it really easy to try things without making permanent changes. And then the last thing I want to talk about is simplicity. You want to make it as easy as possible to do what your user wants to do. I have a real short story here. I have this GIF too. This is me. This is me about like a year ago. I would build tools and be like, why doesn't anyone like them? I love this tool. It's so intuitive and easy to use. And no one uses it, so they're all just dumb. So I know like not all of you necessarily say those exact words, but I'm sure you've thought it at some point, like how it's so easy, how could no one want to use it? And this is one of those times where like you kind of want to be like the customer is always right. If they don't want to use it, there's clearly something that needs to be fixed, even if you think it's a good tool. One example is this like notebook style graphing tool that I started out with, where you are starting to build out your metric. And you're like, I want to change it. I want to add some tags or something. And then you enter it again, and then you'll see your history, so you can like see how you built up that metric. And it turns out people hated this. They actually just didn't want the history. I don't know why. I thought it was great, but the point is, everyone said get rid of it. So I was like, all right, if people think that's the right thing to do, then maybe I should just really do it. But what I realized from talking to people about this tool is that what they were really frustrated by was that input field at the bottom. And so there's a lot of problems with this type of input field. First of all, you have to remember the name of your metric, which is already like a long word that maybe you saved in a doc somewhere. You have to know what aggregators are available to you. You know, there's a whole list of them, like literally like 20. So maybe you want some, but maybe you want average. Maybe you want like one of the percentiles or min and max. There's a lot, and you don't even know what those choices really mean. So it's already kind of confusing in that sense. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I have tags. What are the tag keys? What are the values for those keys? You have to think so hard about all of this stuff just to type this out. And then bonus, like you can downsample. You don't have to, but like a lot of people didn't even realize you could. So there's all these secret features that you didn't even know existed in this magical syntax that we were parsing out. And so all of this is garbage. And what we ended up building instead is this UI form, which I want to acknowledge that it does look similar to OpenTSDB, but there are some features of it that make it a little bit more intuitive, in my opinion. First of all, you have those options that you don't necessarily need to touch. Like, not everyone, you probably don't need to think about the rate or the downsample of your metric if you're just looking at like an hour of data. You also don't need to care if the data is coming from OpenTSDB. We were also using Graphite, so yes, you could manually switch over to Graphite, but most people wouldn't need to. You could go back to power users, like the manual entry, which everyone who had been at the company for 5 years wanted. And then you have the tags, so you don't have to remember what's there, and you can click on it, and it'll show you what's possible. So it shows you all the information you need to remember. without getting really in your way. And so, in my opinion, part of me felt like, no, the old way was so much faster. You could just type stuff out. But when you think about your users and what feedback they're giving you, this is what they're asking for. So to recap, my favorite quote, fastest way to become a 10x engineer is to help 10 other engineers do their jobs better. Again, if you can build a tool that people actually enjoy using or that helps them reach conclusions really quickly, quickly, independently, then you're already doing a great job. You don't have to be building an internal tool in order for this stuff to to be relevant. If you think about applying these tools to like how your team works or how your documentation works or even your command line tools, we'll all be better for it. And as for the lessons, remember education versus intuition. Sometimes if someone asks you how to do something or what something really means, that's when you can tell them about all this information. But otherwise, you just kind of want to get them started and help them feel out what they should be doing. You want them to think about, you don't want them to, you want them to do the right thing, and you want it to be really easy for them to do the right thing and really difficult for them to do the wrong thing. And in terms of what people want, of course, number one is performance. It's totally a part of user experience. I'm sure that's like the more traditional part of our field. You want people to explore things, whether that means letting them use a website like it's an actual real website, making things accessible, and what was the last one? Previews. Yeah, you want people to be able to preview what they're going to do before they hit save. And you want to make it really easy and simple to remember what you need to do. Thanks. I'll take questions now.
Can you maybe speak to the tension between having statistics which are easy to spit out, either cheap or plentiful, and statistics which actually mean something that you can sort of actually understand later on? I spend a lot of time working on the design of things so that when I produce these metrics, they actually mean something you can talk about. But I see most people don't, so I'm wondering why I'm such a loser.
Yeah. Okay, so I think what... I realize you have a mic, but I was told to restate the question, so I'm going to do it anyway. What I think you're asking is, how do you deal with having a bunch of metrics that maybe are very loud and not useful, and then people have to kind of sort out what is going on there, what's actually meaningful? I think that was a hard problem for me at my old job because we let people send whatever metrics they wanted to. And so a lot of times people wouldn't even know what units their metrics were coming in. So they would ask me, and I'd be like, I don't know, I don't see your code. I would say that's one of those times where workshops and training and code review are effective for helping people send the right data if you're at a company where people can send their own metrics. As for what data is useful, I would say in terms of availability data, I think one acronym we throw around a lot at my job now is RED, which I don't remember what the R stands for, but E is error and D is distribution, I believe. Someone can shout out if I'm wrong.
Request,
thank you. I'm glad that worked. I'm at the right conference. So what we usually tell people is are you thinking about the RED? And if you're looking at something else, maybe that's not a great idea. I don't really have a lot of great suggestions other than that, though. Thanks for asking.
What was the tool that you had screen captures of? I missed it when you mentioned.
Okay, what tools? So one of them was an internal tool I built, and then was there a specific one you were remembering?
No, just the screen captures in general. If that was all an internal tool.
Oh, yes. So I should probably annotate this. The one that I was showing was an internal tool, and then there was Datadog and Terraform as well.
Thank you.
More questions? We have 10 more minutes, so we can start the other talk early. Someone's getting up. Other people are getting up.
I'll just talk loudly.
No, please use the mic. It's great for the people who are watching this in the future. I wonder what's happening in the future where people are watching this video.
Future you might be watching it.
Oh, that's so cringy. I hate that you said that. Yes, good news, everyone. We renamed it to observability, so monitoring is done.
So when you're collecting feedback on your monitoring tools, did you use any kind of formal process for that, or did you just like wander down the hall and listen to people's complaints as they screamed into the void?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the question was, what kinds of ways did I use to figure out what feedback people had? So there's a lot. First of all, the most informal would be like Slack. You can kind of search for words like Datadog in your Slack and then hear what people have to say about it. So a lot of the feedback we'd write down from there, we had our like power users who were constantly in our channel like complaining about things, and to be honest, we would often prioritize those features because those people seemed really passionate about it. And then we would also release like biannual surveys. So like every 6 months we would say like, how much do you like working in this programming language? This is like an engineering-wide survey, but we have a whole section about like the observability tools. And what I was really proud of is that we start out with like a 3 out of 7, which is really low for people hating on our tool. And we went up to like a 4, which is neutral, because we made all these changes. And I know that sounds really sad, but like going from people hating on us to people being like, all right, I'm okay with this, that was great. So surveys really helped, and then like free-form feedback in the survey also helped us like measure that we were actually doing the right thing.
Thank you.
Thanks. I thought I saw someone behind you, but then they sat down again, so that's really sad. Should we call it? All right, cool, thanks.